This time around, Nick Sauer and I are going to be looking at a couple of movies in the career of the great stop-motion animator Ray Harryhausen. We're going to be checking out, first off, Jason and the Argonauts from 1963, going a little Jason action, and following that up with one of my absolute favourites, the 1969 Cowboys vs. Dinosaurs movie, The Valley of Gwangi. So sit back, enjoy yourselves, and I'll be back in a moment. The Martian Drive-In Podcast is a discussion of speculative fiction and fantasy movies. We look at the good, the bad and the obscure, the old and the new, English and non-English language science fiction, fantasy and horror films. The podcast is published every 4 weeks, alternating fortnightly with Paleo Cinema Podcast. Feedback is our Soylent Green, and you can provide it by emailing cultguru@gmail.com, cult with a K, or by leaving a comment on the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook through the Soundpipe voicemail recording link at marsdrivein.blogspot.com, or on our phone line, which has changed recently, 206-309-4864. Now, there may be adult content on this podcast, so if you're easily offended, you have our pity. Welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast number 16. My name's Terry Frost, and this time my guest and I, Nick Sauer, are going to do Harryhausen Palooza. We are looking at two Ray Harryhausen movies, first one being Jason and the Argonauts from 1963, the second one being The Valley of Gwangi from 1969. And I've got Nick on the line thanks to Skype. How are you, Nick?
Good. How are you doing, sir?
Oh, well, I'm colder than you are, obviously, because it's winter down here, yeah. And we've had a particularly mean one. We had the coldest few days we've had since the 20th century.
Oh, wow. That's not good.
Which isn't great from your point of view, but from our point of view, it was bloody cold, and I did not enjoy it at all.
Yeah, I hear you on that.
Yeah, and if I could have got a little bit of very localized global warming, I would have been grateful for it. Yeah, so everyone here has kind of been rugging up and pulling up their hoodies and eating lots of soup.
Yeah. Well, on the positive side, this is all going to shift around for the probably by the before our lives are during. Well, we'll never stabilize again during our lifetime. So it's going to be a surprise every year.
Well, that's it. I mean, yeah, it keeps you on your toes. It keeps you interested and all that kind of thing. And the other big news, alternate universe news, is that Australia has a new old prime minister.
Oh, is that the case? I didn't realize he had been before.
So. Yeah, Kevin Rudd ousted Julia Gillard, who happens to be my local member of Parliament, by undermining her in Parliament and out of Parliament for the last 3 years after she ousted him. And I spent a lot of time on, I think, Wednesday night, watching lots of TV and Skyping. No, I wasn't Skyping, but I was posting on Facebook and posting on Twitter all the updates and things like that. So it got very, very dramatic for us.
Yeah.
And I'm not entirely pleased with the result, but if it means we don't get the Conservatives in again, I'm kind of going to have to swallow the bitter pill.
Well, yeah, there's politics is an ugly game, so...
Yeah, it's what they say it was. It was show business for ugly people.
Oh, sorry, that's a great description.
So we've been doing a lot of that. The other thing, I'll let you talk about what you've been watching first, and then I'll get into Man of Steel and a couple of other things. So what have you been watching?
Oh, okay. Well, finished up and posted my review on my blog on In the Flesh, which is a BBC series, three-episode series about the after-effects of a zombie uprising. And, society doesn't collapse, and they're integrating the recently dead back into society after figuring out a way to cure them. So
yeah, I've seen all three episodes of that, and it is quite good quite unforgiving of human nature.
Yeah, the last episode had a content warning, not because of the violence, but because of the subject matters covered, and it richly deserved it. It was pretty stark stuff. Yeah,
it's not a pretty world they live in, is it?
Not really, but it's not unreal either. I mean, from the emotional side of it.
Absolutely, and I recommend if people want to are into that sort of thing. It is very, very good and very well acted too.
Yes,
and the fact that it's all based in one town up in the north of England.
Yes.
Gives it that kind of bubble effect, which works really well.
Yep.
Well, anything else?
Oh, yeah. I've also been, Eric Hollis over at the Movie Waffler sort of tapped me to do some reviews for his site. And I'm actually going through first season of Bates Motel. So I'm going to be doing a review for that. That's actually turning out, I saw the pilot. Diane and I watched it and liked it, but we were kind of booked with stuff. So we decided to wait on catching it. And I'm going through it now. And it's really, I'm quite pleased with what I'm seeing so far.
Okay, yeah, Sal's watching that, but I'm not. I'm kind of. TV series can suck up all my movie watching time, and so I've got to kind of balance the two in a way.
Yep. Yeah, I hear you. And I have the yeah. opposite problem where watching movies sucks up my TV watching time. So.
Yeah, it's one of those things where everyone has their own balance on them, and of course with the political dramas in the middle of the week, they knocked everything into its ass, and people should let us know how they do that. How do you balance out watching TV and watching movies and real life with watching TV and watching movies and things like that? There's this kind of dynamic, and if you're in a relationship particularly, there's a dialogue you've got to enter into.
Yep.
On watching that. I mean, Sal's been watching really weird shit like Two-Headed Shark Attack at the moment, all those really bad asylum films, and she loves them.
Yeah. Well, sci-fi makes a killing with those. That's one of their most, that was one of their big money draws, actually, for the longest time.
Yeah, she eats them like popcorn. It's just crazy. Yeah. And the other thing I've done is Morris Buzinski, who does Love That Album podcast, gave me a 4-disc set of movie trailers.
Awesome.
Yeah, I forget what it's called, DVD Mania or something like that. And each one of the discs got about 2.5 hours. So all up, it's like 10 or 11 hours of movie trailers. That's volume 3 of the series. So I, of course, had to find volume 1 and volume 2.
Right.
So I've got like 30 hours of movie trailers that I just keep watching when I've got a little interstitial time.
Right, and I know the worst part is you're probably sitting here with a notebook just adding to your list of stuff that you know, it's like, okay, I don't have enough to watch already, and now this is adding to it.
Absolutely, so I've been doing that. But the other thing is I watched John Dies at the End. I recommend that. That's a weird little film.
Yeah, I've got that on Netflix streaming on my queue. I haven't gotten to it yet. Kevin Batchelor recommended that as well, actually.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mindfuck, but I enjoyed it. I did see a couple of kind of big-budgety genre films as well. I saw World War Z, or World War Z, as you guys would call it.
Right.
Which,
How was it?
Have you seen
it? No, we haven't gotten to it yet.
There's a structure that a kind of big-budget genre film in the summer season over there needs to have, and you've got to follow the three-act structure. If you're doing a movie that big. Smaller films can get away with breaking the three-act structure, but big tentpole films like this really should have it. And this one doesn't. The third act is a lot slower and less grand than the first two acts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of nothing too much that you haven't seen elsewhere.
Oh, okay.
But there are some great setup pieces. There are some scenes in Jerusalem that are really interesting, and the fact that the zombies swarm like ants makes it a little bit of fun. I saw it in 3D, kind of works with the 3D. I went with a bunch of people from work, and they kind of worked. But that third act is incredibly problematic, and I know they did a lot of reshoots on the back end of the film to try to make it work, but I'm not sure how successful they were. I also saw Jack the Giant Slayer.
Oh, how was that?
Kind of okay. It dates back to, again, a kind of early 60s film, Jack the Giant Killer with Kerwin Matthews, where I think Danforth and his guys did some pretty poor stop motion on it.
Yep.
And, it's one of those movies that, you know, nothing else is on, put it on kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's about two or three more. I saw Wreck-It Ralph, the animated thing with the computer game thing.
I saw that watching on Facebook. What did you think of it? I was going to ask you.
I think it's a bit of a jerk-off for computer gamers.
Oh, yeah, definitely. That's Diane and I, so we just totally love the film. So.
Yeah, so, I mean, at that point of view, you can go enjoy it all. They've got some good actors doing the voice work. They've got John C. Reilly playing Wreck-It Ralph. You've got Sarah Silverman in there and a bunch of other people that bring their personalities and a touch of their personas to it. So it kind of works in that way.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's kind of, I think it's because they were kind of shooting for a kiddie demographic. That's a little bit less edgy than I usually like in that sort of thing.
Yeah, definitely, it is more of a kid-oriented thing. And, I would think if you're not a video game person, you'd probably lose a lot watching that film.
No, well, I've got a lot of the references because I've been geeking out to computer games for a long time. In fact, I'm addicted to one on my iPad at the moment called Dungeon Hunter 4, which has just sucked me right in and sucks up on my spare time. But the other thing I saw last night, and I went specifically so I could talk about it today, was I went to see Man of Steel at my local cinema, 3D, took my own glasses.
Oh, cool.
And I think it kind of works. I'm not that in love with Zack Snyder after Watchmen.
Yeah, I've never been enamored by Zack Snyder's stuff, to be honest.
But I think there's some, I mean, visually it's eye-popping and it's different. Particularly on Krypton, the technology they use there is nothing like the technologies we use.
Oh, cool.
And they make that really plain. And there are some interesting kind of nanotech sort of things that they do, which brings you into the fact that it's another world. But one of the things I've got about Snyder's work is that he does film things very dark.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's not a lot of kind of brightness in there.
Yep.
And that's kind of weird when you're talking about Superman.
Yeah.
I think Henry Cavill's very good at it. Amy Adams, you could have got any one of a dozen actresses to do what she did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny because when we got the Entertainment Weekly in with the Superman on the cover with that outfit he has, it's all like oil stain and stuff, but Diane looks at it and I'm like, what is this, the oil rig Superman? What the hell?
Well, he does go in an oil rig at one stage.
Oh, okay, that might explain the picture
before
we saw.
Before he gets the costume, though.
Oh, okay.
It's kind of a Discovery Channel bit towards the start. Mm-hmm. Where Superman's trying to find himself as a person and goes and works on Deadliest Catch for a little bit and then ends up on an oil rig and works in a bar and somewhere in Canada and all sorts of stuff like that, just as he's trying to find himself. But, the ending's problematic, and this isn't a spoiler because it's been all over the media. They basically, the supervillain Zod and all them, Michael Shannon's quite good in it, trash Metropolis.
Mm-hmm.
To do a point of about 30 or 40 times worse, at minimum 30 or 40 times worse than 9/11.
Right.
And then
I heard the Avengers. What the Avengers did in New York was nothing compared to what happened in Man of Steel.
I totally agree. But the downside to that is, afterwards, Clark goes and works at the Daily Planet, and everyone says, "Here's the new guy, hi, how are you doing?" As if nothing had happened. Now, I know how shell-shocked everybody in the planet was after 9/11.
Yep.
Let alone in New York.
Yeah, exactly.
But the tonally, that bit really is off, because they're like a few blocks away from a place that's been turned to dust, literally.
Yeah.
In a very big swathe of a city. And there must have been tens of thousands of people killed. You can't reset things after something like that in a post-9/11 world.
Right, right.
That's the issue I've got with the movie. Apart from that, I think it may be the start of an okay franchise. It just depends on what they do next.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, I mean, watch this space and just see how it goes.
Yeah. We're probably going to definitely check it out at some point.
You don't need to see it 3D. That's the other thing, too. The 3D doesn't add a lot. And I think it may have been one of those ones that was done 3D in post-production.
Right, yeah.
And I don't think it adds one thing to it. So if you get a chance, if you can get to a 2D session and the 3D is not available, you're not really going to be ripped off.
Yeah, we're not big on paying the 3D tax for movies anyway, so.
I don't mind. If it's 3D, I'll give it a go for 3D. If it's not, I don't particularly have an issue with that.
Yeah.
But, so that's what I've been watching. So we're going to take a break so we can clear our throats. And when we get back, I think we'll do it chronologically.
Okay.
We'll do Jason and the Argonauts first.
Sounds good.
Okay. Now,
From the makers of Sinbad, Columbia Pictures presents Jason and the Argonauts. The mightiest band of warriors the world has ever known.
Turn back, Jason! We're trapped!
Sailing to the ends of the earth, battling against an incredible number of obstacles.
Where will you find this miracle?
I have heard there is a tree at the end of the world, with a fleece of gold hanging in its branches.
In search of the fabulous magic golden fleece, Jason and the Argonauts, caught in the clutches of the towering bronze giant Talos, battered by treacherous falling rocks, taming vulturous harpies, facing the dreaded seven-headed Hydra, battling the merciless army of skeletons. Jason and the Argonauts, the classic story of Jason, a man who challenged the gods. Medea, a temple dancer who betrayed a kingdom for love. The Argonauts, the mightiest band of warriors the world has ever known. Jason and the Argonauts, a classic adventure story, brought to the screen through the incredible special effects magic of Dinorama. Jason and the Argonauts, the search that became a legend.
Okay, and we're back, and that was the trailer to 1963's Jason and the Argonauts. Basically, everyone knows the story. A legendary Greek hero and a team of people go on a quest for the legendary Golden Fleece, and shit gets real.
Yeah.
It stars Todd Armstrong and Nancy Kovac as Jason and Medea. Both their voices are dubbed.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I was not aware of that.
Absolutely. And you've got a guy called Gary Raymond playing Acastus. Lawrence Naismith is Argos, the shipbuilder who builds the Argon. And he's actually in Valley of Gwangi as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, we're going to see him a little bit in part two.
We are. You got Niall McGuinness playing Zeus. Really interesting actor. He played the villain in Night of the Demon, the Jacques Tourneur movie with Dana Andrews. One of the best villains of the 1950s. He's just got that banality of evil thing down pat.
Yes,
and
yes.
He's a little bit of an odd choice for Zeus, I reckon.
Yeah, okay, given that role, yeah. It's, yeah. But Zeus is a bit of a dick if you read mythology. I mean, so.
Yeah. but you need somebody who doesn't look like a shopkeeper.
That is true, yeah.
So basically, they're the things. But before we get into that, and I'd just forgotten that I was going to do this, we're going to talk a bit about Ray Harryhausen and his career.
Yes.
Now, everybody loves Ray Harryhausen. He's been incredibly influential. Anybody who ever did special effects work after Ray Harryhausen owed him a beer.
Yes, they did. Several in some cases.
Absolutely, tons. In fact, one of the interesting things was I was watching The Venture Brothers, the new season of The Venture Brothers on download, and they have a stop motion bit that's kind of slightly Harryhausen-esque.
Oh, that's
just
great.
Just a dead Harryhausen homage, where one of the bad guys, one of the people's having a dream, and the bad guy is a giant kraken, and they bring out a Medusa head, which is actually Dr. Venture's head, and all sorts of things. and one of the guys turns into a centaur Pegasus, and another guy's riding him. It's just totally Harryhausen stuff, and it's done as stop motion, which is lovely.
Oh, that's great.
It's almost kind of an homage to him dying recently. It's just beautifully done, but that shows that even in 2013 the influence is definitely there, and it's quite large. But he started working, he worked with Willis O'Brien a bit in the very late 40s, and started doing his own fairy tale stop motion things off his own back.
Right.
Then he got his dad to do all the armatures right up until his father died in 73, did all the armatures for the stop motion models.
Yep, and he actually recycled a number of them too.
Yep. And one of the things that Harryhausen really brought to the game was that meticulous attention to detail and the ability to create a character out of something that's just a stop motion. Yeah, every 24th of a second, move it a little bit, kind of model, and that's one of the things he brings to both of these movies, which is that tiny detail and that tiny nuance of movement that gives you a character.
Yeah, that's really his trademark. He actually trained as an actor for a bit, but the thing that really sets his stuff apart is they're not just puppets. You know, it's not just a puppet show. He imbues them with character. I mean, every one of them has a unique character.
Yeah. I wonder if that's partly because of the way he did it. I don't think he did the thing that George Pell did with the Puppet Tunes of having a whole bunch of different heads.
No, he did not. And as a matter of fact, he that's actually when he went to work for George Pell, he said he didn't like that whole method of just swapping heads. It didn't work with his style, he felt.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, the detail as well is fantastic. Things like, I was looking at the movie we're going to talk about, Guanji,
mm-hmm.
and there are times when the dinosaurs, you can see them breathing.
Yes.
Because there's some kind of bellows or something he's put in there with the chest, particularly on the Triceratops kind of thing. It moves, and that, you know, most people may not notice that.
Yeah, he got that from Willis O'Brien, by the way. That was O'Brien's trick. He had the little balloons inside the armatures, and he'd puff them up and, you know, let out air. I mean, can you imagine that? The level of detail there is just beyond my imagination. I mean, you know, so in addition to having to adjust the, you know, all the other movements, you have to keep track of, like, how full the thing's lungs are with air, you know, each frame.
Yeah, and that's just magic. I mean, that's beautifully attention to detail.
Yeah.
So, we'll go into a little bit of the Jason and the Argonauts plot. Let me have a look here. I'll go off the IMDb one.
Sure.
Jason has been prophesied to take the throne of Thessaly when he saves Pelias, the king, from drowning,
mm-hmm.
but does not recognize him as the man who had earlier killed his father. Pelias tells Jason to travel to Colchis to find the Golden Fleece. Jason follows his advice and assembles a sailing crew of the finest men in Greece, including Hercules. They are under the protection of Hera, Queen of the Gods, and their voyage is replete with battles against harpies, a giant bronze statue Talos, a hydra, and an animated skeleton Arvi, all brought to life by the special effects wizardry of Ray Harryhausen. And I think it works too. They do have that, I like that conceit of having the gods playing them around like their role-playing games.
Yes, yeah, well, that very much fits. If you've ever read any Greek mythology, I did in college, I read a bunch of it and just out of curiosity, and it really fits very well with the actual Greek mythology. They really were...
Sorry about that. No, yep.
They really were a bunch of dicks, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, you know, gods pretending to be swans and nailing chicks and all sorts of weird stuff like that.
Yeah, Zeus's pick-up techniques were kind of odd, yeah.
They were indeed, but really off. But yeah, Todd Armstrong as Jason, he kind of has the look for it.
Yes, he does.
But I don't think he's particularly a gifted actor.
Well, he actually, if you look at his IMDb, he didn't do a lot of stuff. I was really surprised when I was doing research on him. It's like, whoa, hasn't got a lot of credits.
No. Nancy Kovacs, interesting. So I think she married Zubin Mehta, the conductor.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, it's something. I'm pretty sure I read that. I'll just bring up my IMDb. But yeah, she was hot.
Yes.
I think is the word. She was muy caliente and kind of works. And they've got a kind of weird, slightly Las Vegas-y dance sequence in the temple in Colchis.
Yep.
With Nancy Kovac in it, which kind of is just a little bit odd,
mm-hmm.
but totally in tune with the kind of, you know, the kind of Hollywood stuff they were doing at the time. But she was in a number of things as well. She did episodes of Honey West and Batman.
Yep.
Perry Mason. Let's have a look. She was in Tarzan and the Valley of Gold.
Yep.
The movie. Sure. She did I Spy, one of my favorite TV series of all time.
Yep.
And was she in one of the? I was just trying to think if she was in one of the Matt Helm films, but I can't see her there. So maybe I'm... No, she's in The Silences.
Oh, okay. Oh, she is? Okay, well, that's because... that's right. In Guanji, the woman there who was in like, one of the Flint films. That's what I was thinking of.
Yeah. But, so she was in that, which, again, is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But, again, she had a certain... poise, but not a lot of gravitas.
Yes.
for a kind of queen.
Yep.
Or a princess, or whatever she was.
Yep.
But I think the Argonauts are the interesting characters.
Yes, they are.
Lawrence Naismith is Argos, and Lawrence Naismith with his shirt off isn't a pretty sight. But he does tend to
no man crush there.
Very sure. I mean, I'm sure there are certain guys that find that kind of thing attractive, and more strength to them for that. But the other weird thing, too, and I'm fairly sure of this, but just give me your impressions of it for just a moment while I look this up to confirm it. I've got something I may say, but I just want to confirm it before I do.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. So, yeah, where did you first see the film?
Oh, I saw it, I was pretty young at the time. It was on TV, and it was just, you know, one of these Saturday movie things, and I saw it, and I actually have it on VHS. Then I had to borrow, get the Netflix disc to watch it because I couldn't find my VHS copy, of course. This is, I think, my third time through, and I really like it a lot, actually. I'm surprised that there's a number of things that jumped out at me this time through it, actually, that I'd missed, you know, from the previous two viewings.
Yeah, there was at least one Doctor Who in the
yes.
movie as well.
Yep, Patrick Troughton as Phineas.
Yes, he was definitely in there. But the other interesting bit, apart from Honor Blackman playing Hera,
yes, talking of Hart, why don't we go right to Hera?
Yeah, oldest Bond girl yet.
Yeah,
not 39 when she did Goldfinger.
Uh-huh.
But and the other interesting bit is Nigel Green playing Hercules, because Nigel Green was a fairly fit guy,
mm-hmm.
but he wasn't really the people were used to all of those peplum movies at the time.
Right,
and having. A hairy bear of a guy like Nigel Green, who is not massively muscular, playing Hercules, was a really interesting choice. But I think he brings it across
right. And actually, yeah. Again, if you read the mythology, that's he looks what I got the impression Hercules looked like. You know, he wasn't this muscle bound guy. He was certainly well built, but he wasn't like, you know, a bodybuilder type. You know.
Yeah, but that was the conceit at the time because
right.
everybody had seen all the Italian movies.
Right. That. Yep.
There was a little bit of talk at the time about Hercules being a little bit weedy. But they also kind of have an allusion to Hercules' sexuality a little bit when he stays on the island of Talos
to
find his friend.
Yeah, because he's not convinced he's dead, yeah.
Yeah, we see him die, but Hercules isn't convinced of it. But, mm-hmm. On with the special effects, I mean, you could start out with Talos, because Talos is probably one of the really big ones that works well, the giant bronze statue that comes to life.
Yep. You know what the original version of Talos was in the story, by the way, and why they went with a bronze statue?
Was it a puppy?
No. No, it was actually a man-sized bronze statue, animated yep. bronze statue, and it sat in a fireplace, in a fire pit that it was going, and then it would run over and hug people and, like, burn them to death with its, like, you know, red huff, you know, body at that point, which... I think Harry has that line, like, there's no way we could show that on film to
yeah.
kids, you know?
But that would be a good way. It would be good at barbecues because you could get him to, like, hug a cow carcass.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Or, you know, put him in a honey pit and just let him cook all the vegetables.
Yeah,
there you go. But, yeah, I can see that. But that's the other thing, too. Talos in the movie, when they find his Achilles heel, boom,
yep.
Is full of hot liquid.
Yep.
Which is really odd. But I think, as a character, I mean, they do give that impression of the size and the weight of him. I mean, Harryhausen's stop motion there does give you a sense of the mass of Talos.
Yes.
That's really kind of interesting.
Well, just also the scene when they you know, after Hercules takes a spear right out of the treasure trove under at the base, and that just the scene where Talos' head first turns and looks at them is pretty chilling.
Because he's got to kind of look down at an angle, too.
Yes.
And Harryhausen keeps that neck looking just right.
Yep.
And it's a remarkable piece of work. And then you've got things like the harpies, and of course flying things must be a lot harder to do stop motion on as well.
Oh, yeah, because you've got extra limbs there.
And also they're suspended to an extent.
Yep.
And just keeping that, you know, if you drop something, oh, geez, I've got to start again kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And Patrick Troughton being, of course, the blind man who is being tortured by the harpies because the gods are bastards.
Yep.
Is quite good in this one as well. In fact, there have been two Doctor Who's in Ray Harryhausen movies as well. Tom Baker was in one of the Sinbad movies.
Golden Voyage of Sinbad, yep.
Golden Voyage of Sinbad, yeah. So,
awesome villain, by the way. He does a great villain.
Yeah, but that's what I kept expecting Niall McGuinness to do, because I've seen Niall McGuinness being such a great villain in Night of the Demon.
Yep.
I wanted his Zeus...
Mm-hmm.
to really have a bit more menace about him, but he's very urbane playing.
Yeah. But I thought it worked, though. I mean, it worked for me.
Yeah, well, maybe I'm pickier too. But he's also been in a couple of other movies I like The Kremlin Letter, the John Huston spy movie from the late 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So he's in that as well. Michael Gwynn, an interesting actor who at one stage played Frankenstein's monster in a Frankenstein movie for Hammer.
Mm-hmm.
He plays Hermes and also a priest in the film. You got Douglas Wilmer, another well-known English character actor, playing Pelias.
Mm-hmm.
And just a whole bunch of familiar faces there. I think they filmed it off the coast of Italy, as I recall.
Oh, okay.
And the landscapes are really nice. They've got that kind of rugged, calcareous rock kind of look about the place.
Yeah.
Which does really make it... You know, they filmed it on the Mediterranean. Yeah, it was around Campania in Italy.
Yeah.
A lot of it. A lot of it, the stuff was done at Shepperton Studios, all the indoor stuff.
Mm. But it really looks right. It feels right. There's no question that you're in that area of the world, really.
Yeah, and they've got that beautiful figurehead on the Argo, which faces inwards rather than outwards.
Right.
Of Hera, and that'd be such a great thing to have in your house.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that'd be one of the go-to collectibles.
Yeah. For this kind of thing. Right. You know, the eyes that open up and everything. Yeah.
Yeah, it really does kind of work in a good way. In fact, I like this movie a lot more than I like the original Clash of the Titans, which I don't particularly like reason. I think Harryhausen's work on it is great,
mm-hmm.
but there's a lot of the actors in that I just don't like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I that's actually the one one of the few Harryhausen films I have not gotten to yet, just because the owl keeps scaring me away. You know, after Star Wars has became this thing, you have to have these, like, goofy companions in every movie. And I've got it on DVD. I own it on DVD, so I'm sure I'll get to it, but it just...
Yeah. The owl actually turns up in the Venture Brothers as well.
Oh, really?
Turns up in the Venture Brothers episode. They use so many great references to classic geek culture in that series. It's just a lot of fun. But, there are two boys. There's Billy Quizboy and his Augustus St. Cloud, who's his nemesis.
Mm-hmm.
And they keep fighting on trivia, and Augustus St. Cloud collects memorabilia from movies.
Uh-huh.
So he's got, like, the original statue from Raiders of the Lost Ark, and mm-hmm. he's got one of the pods from the Cronenberg Fly movie.
Uh-huh.
All sorts of shit in the background. It's just a lot of fun watching that, and they do reference this movie a fair bit. But then, of course, we get on to the Hydra.
Yep.
How many heads? It's got 5 or 6, depending on how many you cut off.
Was it 7? I thought it was 7.
Could be 7, yeah, 7, and then you cut one off and 2 grow in its place, which is really unfair.
Right, yeah.
But the Hydra works really well, too. It's got that kind of... It does work as a scary thing.
Right. Yeah, I like the heads. They look like these, like, weird, sort of bizarre serpentine, you know, parrot-type heads. They're really creepy-looking.
Yeah, they are. And, of course, when it is destroyed, the teeth are collected by the priest of Colchis.
Yep.
And spread across the ground, and the skeleton dries up.
Yep. Children of the Hydra's teeth.
Yeah, Children of the Hydra's teeth. And I think they had 7 of them all up.
Yep.
And Harryhausen spent 4 months in the sequence of... this fight with the skeletons.
Yep.
4 months. Just incredibly meticulous work. And they are... They don't look human in a real sense. They do look kind of slightly insectile as well.
Yeah, they definitely do, yeah.
Yeah, which is something he kind of used again when he did First Men in the Moon just after this film.
Mm-hmm.
It's got they do look a little like the Selenites, and they move a little like the Selenites, but it is really good that they don't have them moving like a human being.
Right,
yeah. Because whatever is moving their muscle, or where their muscles would be,
right,
isn't quite the same as would be moving a person's. And I think that Harryhausen really thought it through,
mm-hmm.
Having those there. And they do have a menace. And any movie set in this kind of milieu after that with anything magical, it's got to have a skeleton in it somewhere these days. It's just one of those touch points.
Yeah.
You've got to have an animated skeleton.
Unwritten rule, yeah.
Any number of role-playing games, whether they're done on a board or done on a computer, you've got to have an animated skeleton in there now and then. The one I'm playing, Dungeon Hunter 4, has animated skeletons as one of the monsters.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But yeah, I mean, this movie, anybody who saw it in their childhood, it was cooler than Star Wars because it didn't really talk down to kids the way I think Star Wars does a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's just got, I mean, nobody gives a fuck about the hero. Everyone thinks Medea's hot.
Yeah.
The Argonauts are interesting characters in their own right, and they're much more interesting than the hero.
Yeah.
It's the monsters and the villains that people come to this movie for.
Yeah.
And if people don't have it on DVD, there's no reason you shouldn't have.
Yeah, I was also surprised watching it this time. I'd forgotten the first two times I watched it, how they really set it up for a sequel that never happened.
Yeah. I really like the Golden Fleece, too.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that thing would look good hanging over any couch in any house.
Yeah, I agree, yeah.
It's got sparkly bits in it. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that when it's hanging on the kind of dead tree branch that it's draped over,
mm-hmm.
it really does pop. And then when you pick it up, sometimes it loses the luster a little bit, as if you're taking it away from where it should be.
Right, yeah. It only glows again when he uses the effect to...
To resurrect people. Yeah. But it really is a classic film.
Yeah.
There was a kind of TV miniseries, I think, made in 2000 of Jason and the Argonauts.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But, yeah, which I think had... Just give me a few moments and I'll find it. But I think I recall seeing it, but I don't remember anything that's in it.
That's
which is probably
a statement right there.
Well, that's a yeah. Okay. But I'll just get the details up. I think I'm just trying to work it. Yeah, there's a TV movie. And there was a TV series in there. But Jason London, Frank Langella, Nastasia Henstridge.
Right. Now I remember. Okay, so it's Frank Langella, yeah.
Yeah. They had Derek Jacobian, Angus McFadden playing Zeus. Dennis Hopper playing Pelias.
Uh-huh. That's interesting, but
shit, I've got to rewatch this now. it's got a good kind of supporting cast.
Mm-hmm.
Brian Thompson, big British actor in there. Mm-hmm. Kieran Hines is in it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now I'm going to have to watch it. I should not have looked at that. I'm going to have to waste my time watching it. $30 million budget. It was made for Hallmark, so it probably isn't going to be too interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got a few interesting actors in it, and there was a TV series done in 2003, and I'm not even going to look that up because otherwise I want to watch it.
Yeah.
But, the director of Jason the Argonauts, while we're getting into the movie-making part of it, was Don Chaffee, who did a lot of interesting movies, and also Pete's Dragon for Disney.
Yep.
He did 1 Million Years B.C.,
mm-hmm.
with Raquel Welch in a fur bikini. Yep. So everybody can thank him for that. He did some episodes of Danger Man, which I'm watching at the moment, with Patrick McGoohan.
Oh, cool. That's a great series, by the way.
It is. And it just every episode is just so concise and tight. He did episodes of Fantasy Island.
The Prisoner, too, actually. The Prisoner episodes.
Yep. Charlie's Angels.
Yeah.
And other lesser things. Okay, just to wind up, I'm going to have another drink now because my throat is giving out of me.
Mm-hmm. News from Mars.
Yep, we'll do some news from Mars after we have a break, and then we will hit some Guanji.
For you see, nothing ever happens on Mars. No sports are entertainment.
Okay, we're back, and news from the planet Mars. I missed it out last time, I do apologise, but we do have some news from Mars, even though it rarely changes. Now, we've got something here from the University of Oxford, so you know it's good. It says Mars had an oxygen-rich atmosphere 4 billion years ago. Differences between Martian meteorites and rocks examined by NASA rovers can explain if Mars had an oxygen-rich atmosphere well before the rise of atmospheric oxygen on Earth. So it's about 15 billion years before Earth had an oxygen atmosphere. NASA's Spirit rover examined surface rocks in the Gusev crater on Mars. The fact that the rocks are 5 to 10 times richer in nickel than the meteorites was puzzling and cast doubt on whether the meteorites had typical volcanic products of the Red Planet. What was shown is both meteorites and the surface volcanic rocks are consistent with similar origins in the deep interior of Mars, but the surface rocks came from a more oxygen-rich environment.
Mm.
So the stuff that had been thrown out of volcanoes had a certain chemical composition.
Right.
And elemental composition. But the other ones had a lot more oxygen in them. So chances are Mars was much nicer than Earth at one stage.
Yep.
Which is kind of interesting and gives rise to the possibility of life, because we've found out, of course, that comets have amino acids in them.
Yep.
And they're the precursors of life as we know it.
Yeah. Well, bacterial life seems fairly commonplace. It's the complex animal life that gets tricky.
Yeah. Well, particularly if you're out in the bush with it, yeah. But, yeah, so that's it. So at some stage, Mars was pretty good, and, of course, Civil War soldiers travelled there and met up with Red Princesses.
Yep.
And all of that jazz. So, yeah.
Giant green guys with four arms, yes.
Yep, with voices like Willem Dafoe. There is a really high-resolution picture that the Curiosity rover took of Mars, too, if you want to look around and find it, people. And it's incredibly high pixel density, so they must have obviously had a really great camera there. And you can just zoom into it and look at the Martian rocks in the semi-distance and get very high-res pictures of them. And it does look like someone's gravel driveway. As a lot of Mars does. It's just the high quality of the cameras on that rover are just mind-blowing when you see the pictures.
Yeah, it's definitely worth just looking at all the photographs that thing's taken.
It does kind of let you associate better with the place. I mean, the low-res ones we got out of the early probes in the 1970s were one thing, but these things, because of that eye-popping clarity, really do up the wow factor a lot.
Yep.
But that's it. Mars was nicer than Earth at one stage, and now it's not.
Yeah. But so that's what happens when your core freezes and you have a mini disturbance.
Sorry, you're breaking up a little bit.
This is what happens when your planetary core freezes and you only have a mini disturbance to keep all the nasty radiation out.
Yeah. And, we're a lot luckier than that than they were, too. But, Mars, still an interesting place, and we're finding out more and more interesting things about it all the time. So that was the news from the planet Mars, and I'm now going to get on with The Valley of Gwangi, 1969. The Valley of Gwangi, one of my favourite films of the 1960s, because I think I saw it in 1970 on my birthday.
Right. Oh, good.
At the good old Regal Cinema, which, again, is one of my favourite flea pits of all time, and I've put pictures up on the Paleo Cinema website that I found.
I was just going to ask you, is that the one you put the pictures up on?
Yeah, it is. It's iconic in my movie viewing history, because I saw so many films. I mean, I was talking with Morris over at Love That Album when we talked about Head last week, and that's just been released, podcast we did on Head, that I saw it at that cinema as well. And there's a Facebook page for people who remember old Sydney cinemas.
Oh, cool.
And people who actually had gone to the Regal as kids, one of the movies they always mentioned was Head. So a couple of them mentioned Valley of Gwangi as well.
Oh, cool.
That they had seen it there. So these things do stick with you when you see them as a child, which makes me a little more sympathetic, but not very much, to the people who think Star Wars was marvellous. The fact that they saw it as a kid, it's not anything to do with the quality of the movie, particularly. But Valley of Gwangi, it's an old, this was originated as an old Willis O'Brien project that never got off the ground. It was just called Gwangi at that stage, and there were a lot of storyboards that Willis O'Brien did and gave to Harryhausen. It's got people in it that I do like. Again, it's got Lawrence Naismith,
yep,
playing Professor Bromley,
yep,
a paleontologist. You've got James Franciscus, who I like, playing Tuck Kirby, who's just basically an itinerant cowboy with a very good wardrobe.
Yeah, exceptionally good wardrobe for 1890, yeah.
Yeah, he's got about two or three really nice suits that he wears most of the time. You got Gila Golan playing TJ. Yeah. She was in one of the Flint movies as well. She was also Miss Israel from 1961.
Yeah. Did you read her background, by the way? Real interesting background on her.
Yeah, she was found wandering as a toddler,
yep,
and taken in by a Catholic family in Poland during World War II.
Yep.
And her real name was Miriam Goldberg.
Mm-hmm.
Not sure why they changed it, but yeah, she did end up being Miss Israel in 1961. She did a few movies, and now apparently she's runs an investment company or something like that.
Yep, yep. From her husband, yeah. That she actually, Gwangi was her last film. And she married and had kids. She just had to start a family.
Yeah. And you got Richard Carlson, of course, who we remember from things like The Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of harks back to that 1950s era. And things like He Came from Outer Space, I think he was in.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
You got Lawrence Naismith, as I said, and Freda Jackson, an interesting character, playing the old gypsy lady. She was actually an English actress.
Yes.
And you've got, of course, the token kid, Curtis Arden, playing Lope, who's basically one of those standard things you have in these movies set in Mexico at the time. The little kid who doesn't seem to have any family, but is an entrepreneur running a tourist business on his own.
Yep, yep.
I mean, there were any number of those kids running around the place. It wasn't actually filmed in Mexico. It was filmed in Andalusia in Spain, which is why they have all the flamenco dancing in one scene. But it's got the usual kind of spaghetti western landscapes, but I think they'd use them really well in this film. Those kind of rocky, arid, hilly landscapes.
Totally worked for me, and I would never have guessed.
Absolutely, and it's just lovely to look at. And they've got that little pre-title sequence where one of the guys is obviously wounded and is carrying something that squeals in a bag.
Yeah.
And eventually is found by the gypsy lady with her dwarf companion,
yep,
as you do, and just tells them Gwangi, Gwangi, and all that kind of thing, a little bit like the little girl in Them.
Yeah.
And then they cut to that really nice Jerome Moros score.
Mm-hmm.
I really do like the soundtrack of this one.
Yeah, it's very, very good.
Yeah, it's kind of lopes along there. It's kind of a good standard of adventure score, but I do really like it a lot. Yeah, do you remember you first saw this one?
This one was actually one of the later Harryhausen films. I actually caught it on, I think, TCM or something. I only saw it like first time like 5 or 10 years ago, probably 10 years ago now I think about it. So, I actually want to give a shout out to my friend Mark Leeper for giving me the 11th hour lending of his DVD of the movie for the podcast here. So this is literally my second viewing of it.
Yeah, I've actually seen it like 5 or 6 times now, and I do like it. I like the kind of the fact that Professor Bromley is so enthusiastic, and of course the plot. I should do a little bit of the plot line here.
Yeah, that's true.
Let me flip over the page. Cowboy James Franciscus seeks fame and fortune by capturing an Allosaurus living in the Forbidden Valley. Yeah, let me start again. Cowboy James Franciscus seeks his fame and fortune by capturing an Allosaurus living in the Forbidden Valley in Mexico and putting it in a Mexican circus. His victim, called Gwangi, turns out to be more than he can handle. So that's basically it. But at the start, they don't find Gwangi. They find an Eohippus.
Yes, who's go ahead.
A dawn horse. One of the precursors of a horse. It's about the size of a capybara.
Yep. yeah, he totally steals the show, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it's crazy cute, and this again shows Harryhausen's skill at making character. The fact that this little thing made out of fur and metal armatures
has
real character.
Yeah,
and I really like that. I just think it's a beautiful little creation, and the fact that they teach it to dance to a music box.
Yeah.
For the show they're planning is kind of cute.
Yes, I thought that was just marvelous.
Yeah. Nobody ever found out what happened to the Eohoopas after they got Guanji anyway.
Right, yeah.
Maybe
took off back into the valley, probably hanging out with the other Eohoopi. Right?
Yeah, well, it probably is. It's probably making baby Eohoopi.
Good for him.
But, it's just one of those great characters, and of course they go back to find where it came. The gypsies steal it.
Right,
and decide to return it to the valley, otherwise Guanji will come and get everybody, as if Allosaurus is actually look after Eohippi for some reason.
But that works so well for them there. The return doesn't matter, yeah.
it really doesn't work well, and nothing ends well for the people who steal Eohippi.
Yeah.
But, so they find the hidden valley, and they kind of break open an opening into it so they can get their horses in.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks Tuck stole it because he had a relationship with TJ, the character played by Gila Golan, who does an act at the circus of diving into a large tank of water with a horse.
Yeah.
As you do. And, but then there's a little bit of Harryhausen there too with the horse and the girl dropping into the tank. It's about a second's worth of footage.
Right, yes, and maybe because they were scared about actually hurting horses and people and actors.
Yeah, you don't really want to drop an actress and a horse into a tank with a big fringe of flame around it in real life.
Yeah.
And that's probably one of the weakest effect sequences in the movie, I think. It really doesn't work.
Really? I actually didn't even know for sure it was a visual effect until I read it, actually. And I didn't...
Okay.
I had problems with other things in the movie, which we'll get to, but I didn't. That one actually worked okay for me. I guess I just didn't catch it.
Yeah, and the other thing that I find a bit odd, well, we might as well hit the things we find odd with it.
Mm-hmm.
Why is Guanji blue?
Yeah, the coloration thing problem I had was with the Pteranodon, where they actually built full scale Guanji and Pteranodon, as well as the stop motion figures, and the colors in the Pteranodon really don't match up, so it's kind of really obvious as you switch between, the live action versus the stop motion stuff, and I found that really distracting.
Yeah, that's one of the big things that Harryhausen had trouble with, and he admitted it,
mm-hmm.
when he went from black and white to color.
Oh, really?
He's getting those color values right. It really was a hard thing to... Because he may be using different film stock than they used to film their background sequences.
Right, right.
Film stock can vary so much. It wasn't like you could go in now and tweak the color palette.
Right.
The way you can with modern movies. So he always had that as an issue. And he was actually reluctant to move to color movies for that reason.
Oh, okay.
Back in the days of Gulliver and things like that.
Yeah. So the blue Allosaurus threw you off a bit.
It did a little bit. I mean, it does now, but when I saw it as a kid, I loved it, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But, there are some great things. I think the other thing that put me off a little bit, looking at it from now, is the tail lashing.
In what way?
Well, the Guanji's tail lashes around a lot,
mm-hmm.
like a snake or something like that, and I think maybe a little less of that would have put it across better. We've seen...
Oh, okay.
Possibly because I've seen dinosaurs done more recently, of course, when people know a lot more about dinosaur physiology.
Oh, right.
And the tails don't kind of
right.
move around quite so much.
I guess I kind of just wrote it off as, it's a fantastic fantasy version of a dinosaur, so it didn't... I thought it added character to Guanji. I mean, Guanji was like a total badass in this film. I mean,
yep. And then they've got those great sequences of lassoing Guanji.
Yes, that was awesome stuff.
Where they had great big poles on top of jeeps.
Yeah,
the people to throw the lassos over that were at the right height so people could get the eye lines. they could get the lines in, and then Harryhausen had to match them up with bits of wire.
Right, and then they had to film it from both sides too. They actually shot the left side because it's they've got cowboys on both sides of Guanji roping.
Yeah.
So they had to film the left side cowboys with the jeep on one film, and then the right side cowboys with the jeep on another film, and they actually had to merge the two film sequences together and put Guanji where the jeep was. So I mean, that's an incredible sequence. I mean,
it's a lot harder to do in those days than doing it these days, of course, because software does it all for you.
Until you just whip it up on a computer, you're good.
In spite of that, I like it. I think James Franciscus is a lot more engaging protagonist than Todd Armstrong was in Jason and the Argonauts.
I definitely agree with that. Yeah.
He's a little bit kind of teeth gritting him, but he was a good looking guy, and he had some chops as an actor, as a lot of his TV work showed.
Well, he definitely came across as like a sleazy, entrepreneur, car salesman type guy, anything for a buck kind of guy.
Yeah. And, I think he works well with the kid.
Yeah.
I mean, the kid's not particularly a good actor, Lope.
he only had two roles, actually, this and there was a TV show, I think.
Yeah, well, that's it. I don't know how much parents push kids into this sort of thing.
Yeah.
I think that James Franciscus works really well with him.
Yeah.
And you can see, if you look carefully, him bringing out the best in the kid.
Yep, definitely.
And that's just kind of a sign of a generous actor, I think. I always find that interesting. When you've got people, one person's got a lot more skill than the other, how generosity from the person with the skill can really lift a scene.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and all credit to James Franciscus. Died very early. He was about 59 or something like that.
Yeah.
And died of cancer in about 1991.
Now, was that what got him? Yeah, I was wondering, because I noticed he died young, relatively speaking.
Which is a shame, because if he had lived 10 years or more, he would have ended up in Tarantino films.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, he would have been one of those guys that Tarantino brought in to play a cowboy in Django or something like that.
Yeah,
I liked Franciscus in a lot of things. Of course, he was in the second Planet of the Apes movies.
Yep.
And did a lot of TV work, Long Street.
Mm-hmm.
Did a TV series about a blind detective, which had Bruce Lee in it. He was actually a student of Bruce Lee's.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Which is kind of really interesting. He did an early TV series called Mr. Novak, where he played a school teacher.
Yep.
And things like that. He did a lot of things in the late 50s, like Alfred Hitchcock Presents. He's in a few of those.
Yeah.
Really, I think, very personable actor.
Mm-hmm.
Gila Golan, not so much. They dubbed her voice as well. Because she did have a fairly thick accent.
Yep.
Which, you see in the Flint movie she did.
Yeah. Oh, they dubbed her there too.
They didn't dub her in the Flint.
Oh, you're saying you see the accent? Okay, you see the accent.
Yeah, the accent does show up a lot in that. The accents aren't bad, but I think if you do have a fairly strong accent and you're not a particularly strong actor, she's in the Iron Man Flint.
Yeah.
That kind of works against it. You're not only struggling against with an unfamiliar language. You're struggling to do something that you don't particularly have training in.
Yeah. Well, today it seems like they just train them to do different accents anyway. I mean, I remember Diane was watching something on True Blood. That's one of her shows I kind of watch because she does. And they had, I'm listening to the interviews and there's these English accents and I get in there and it's Bill Compton and Jason Stackhouse for these English accents. And I'm like, what the hell's going on? And it turns out they're British actors.
Half of the actors in Hollywood are Australian as well.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, the guy that does The Mentalist is Australian. You've got a whole bunch of other people around the place who do it. Tony Collette, of course, is Australian.
Yeah.
Just a whole bunch of really fine actors that we pump out of the places like the National Institute of Dramatic Arts.
Oh, good.
Which is where Mel Gibson came from, but he didn't get a lot of his political attitudes from there. Because that's a notoriously lefty kind of place.
I would be surprised if he did.
Yeah, I think he got them from his father, but Mel Gibson... I'll leave off Mel Gibson because he's such an asshole.
You don't want to go down that rabbit hole, right?
I don't want to go down that road. But, I do find this really interesting when you're watching older films.
Mm-hmm.
There are incredibly beautiful women and handsome guys in a number of films, but they couldn't act their way out of a speeding ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And I always, depending on whether I like them or not, I always feel really bad about them, or I kind of don't give a shit about them in a way. But Gila Golan, yes, she was a very attractive person. I think, but it's awkward seeing someone attractive trying to act when they can't.
Mm-hmm. Well, I always assume that was how Americans, as Americans, how we chose our actors. It was based more on appearance than actually acting talent, per se.
Yeah. And you can always tell the difference, too, if you look back on people's biographies.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who did any stage work at all,
yep,
is usually a much better actor.
Yeah.
Because they've got the basic tools of the trade. And there are other people who've picked it up and have improved as actors. Paul Newman, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
You look at him in The Silver Chalice and then anything he did more than about 6 years after that.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell that guy has really, really tried hard,
yeah,
to improve his craft.
Yep.
So, yeah, it can be done. And there are cases, I mean, even some female actors get much, much better.
Yeah.
And it's nice to see, too, that, you know, people who persist can kind of get enough to be a jobbing actor.
Yeah.
But, yeah, getting back to Guanji, Io Hip is very good. Guanji itself was really good. The bit where Guanji pulls the rope off itself with that little front paw.
Yeah, yeah.
Which could have looked really fake, but it's just such a natural movement.
Yes. Well, you see him scratching his face earlier, and when Tuck's like watering his horse there in the valley, and Guanji, yep, comes around the corner in the river, and is like just sort of, you know, meandering around doing whatever allosauruses do in their spare time, and he just, yep, he scratches his face. So you saw as that's just how he works, you know.
Yeah, and that's beautifully thought out by Harryhausen, because, yeah, he had so much influence on pre-production in all of these movies he did.
Yep.
That, you know, he really did think it through a lot. And then, of course, you got the bit with the pterodactyl.
Yes.
Where the guy...
It's a pteranodon. They call it pterodactyl, but it's really a pteranodon.
Yeah. Yeah, where the guy's wrestling the pteranodon. That works really well. I mean, breaking the neck on a pteranodon is definitely a macho move.
Yes. Not the easiest thing to pull off, yes.
But it really works well. I'm not sure whether something that size could pick up a small Mexican boy.
Well, that's again getting to the thing where we know about dinosaurs. That's a scene that kind of, you know, throws me off with like the tail for you, that we now know that the pteranodons and stuff were probably largely gliders as opposed to actually, you know, flapping type creatures.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, but they didn't know that at the time.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
Didn't expect it in this sort of movie, I suppose.
Yeah, I can roll with it. Yeah.
Yeah. But they capture Guanji mostly because Guanji is stupid enough to drop a mountain on his own head.
Yeah.
They build a wagon and schlep it back to the town, and decide they're going to show it off in a big circus,
yep,
cage.
Yeah.
With a big curtain around it,
and that's when
lifted up by a helium balloon.
Yep, big balloon, and that's when the gypsy woman there decides she has to make the curse come true. So she sends her assistant in there to help out.
And yeah,
doesn't end well for him. But
here's a word of advice for gypsy midgets: never ever unbolt a cage with a live Allosaurus in it.
Yes,
it's not going to end well.
Good life advice, sir.
It's going to scare the children, and I was a bit sad about Professor Bromley. I don't think he deserved his fate.
Yeah, I was kind of upset by that too. Yeah,
yeah, because he was essentially a harmless character. Yeah, he wanted to get a knighthood and be well known for his work with Allosaurus.
Right, but his heart was in the right place. That's the thing.
Yeah, it was. He was actually a nice guy. He's helping out a little orphan kid with jobs, and then gets a cage dropped on him. It's just not right.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Guanji goes rampaging through the town, and
after beating up the circus elephant, yeah.
Yeah, basically chewed an elephant. Elephant was doing well there for a little bit.
Yep.
But Guanji, a little bit faster, a little bit smarter.
And a little bit better equipped.
A little bit better equipped. So those tusks were pretty good.
Yep.
But in general, what happened was Guanji got away and then chased the protagonist into a church.
Yep.
Fortunately, it was a Catholic church and had a lot of candles in it and a lot of oil-burning lamps
yep.
and that kind of thing. Yeah, you'd be shit out of luck if you went in a modern megachurch because it's all electric now.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But yeah, there was enough there that they could...
Things called fire codes and things like that.
Yeah, but there was a big advantage there too. Not only did they get rid of a rampaging Allosaurus, but they burnt down a church.
Yep. That's it.
Which, from my little atheist point of view here...
favor to humanity.
Is a win-win. Is a win-win. but yeah, and I think, again, this harks back to The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, one
yes,
of the earlier
definitely.
Things that Harryhausen did. Again, getting rid of a dinosaur with fire.
Yep.
In an amusement place.
Yep.
And, yeah, they
you're
do.
You're a
and
cruel, cruel man, Mr. Frost.
Yeah, well, you know, I've got to go where my heart is with this kind of stuff. But, yeah, it's, and there was that weird long tracking shot across the crowds watching Guanji burn to death in the church. I mean, I think they lingered on that just a little bit too long in the direction. It just seemed a slightly odd way of doing
it. Now that you mention it, yeah, thinking it back to it, it is kind of odd now that you mention it, yeah.
Yeah, just slightly odd there. And when you've burnt down the dinosaur, mm-hmm. you kind of tend to, if you have a look at, say, Hammer horror films and other things like that,
mm-hmm.
you do show the people kind of standing there watching the flames and that.
Yeah.
But it's not something you linger on. It's something you put the end titles over.
Yeah, did the Delope crying seem a little forced to you as well? Because I remember thinking that was a little too much.
Maybe somebody pinched the kid's arm to make him cry. Now step on the kid's foot. We need him to cry right
now.
Yeah. Something like that. But, yeah, I mean, Guanji works well. In spite of the carping we've done, it's just a lot of fun.
Yep.
It's a good, honest Saturday matinee popcorn film, which is how I saw it originally.
Oh, yeah. No, and, I would definitely watch it again without hesitation. So.
And it's Harryhausen at his best, you know, allowing for the tail and the bits you found a bit off on the colour values. Just watching the detail. I mean, Harryhausen's monsters always bear close scrutiny.
Yes.
Yeah. And just seeing that a little bit and knowing that everything you see there is something that Ray Harryhausen thought of and meticulously made happen.
Yeah.
And I think that's the joy of watching his stuff, is knowing that everything you see that's not being done by human beings in the background comes from the beautiful care the man took in creating creatures out of basically dolls.
Yes.
And all credit to Harryhausen. Someone should start a museum for him or something.
Yes, I agree. There should be some sort of some place where you can look at his stuff and understand.
Yeah. The other interesting thing is, ever since 1960, he's lived in the UK.
Yes.
Rather than going to Hollywood and sucking on that teat,
mm-hmm.
he decided to live and work in the UK because he liked the place.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of his best work came out of that move. Anything after 1960 is definitely Harryhausen's best work. Maybe there wasn't as much pressure to do things quickly.
Yeah.
But it's making movies over there. And
it also allows him to not have people looking over his shoulder and stuff. So.
Absolutely. Even though this one was done by Warner Brothers, the Warner Brothers distributed, and that distance would have kind of given him the slack. I mean, this isn't something you can do well and do fast.
Yeah.
If you look at things like Jack the Giant Killer, the one that Jim Danforth did, it was a very much a rush job.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell that it's, the stop motion in particular.
Oh, really? How fast did they make that? I didn't appreciate that about that film.
I think they made it pretty fast, but if you have a look at the stop motion, the monsters aren't particularly well made.
Okay.
And there's a slight jerkiness to them. And I know Danforth did a lot of better work than that in things like The Wonderful World of the Brothers Grimm.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely think that Jack the Giant Killer doesn't hold up well for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows that if you want, you can have fast or you can have good.
Right.
Particularly with stop motion. There is really no in between.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
But I think that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've basically barbecued Guanji.
Such as it were, yeah.
and it's just great to be able to say something about Ray Harryhausen after he died.
Yes.
And to kind of respect the art.
Thank him for our wonderful childhoods, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I would rather have him to thank for the wonderful experiences of my childhood than have George Lucas.
Not because you're biased or anything.
Oh, I'm unashamedly biased. I think George dumped down and did an enormous disservice to science fiction film.
Mm-hmm.
I think by making it all about the spectacle rather than about the essence of it.
Yeah. Well, I always used to start the whole Star Wars thing as more of a fantasy than science fiction franchise myself, anyway.
Yeah, but, I mean, no, that's my other theory, too, is all the best fantasies in Penthouse Letters.
I would agree with you.
But, anyway, so on that note, we'll wrap it up, and I'll do the feedback a little bit later.
Okay.
Thank you, Nick, for being a part of this.
Oh, no always, problem.
And I know that you and I share a love of this kind of stuff, so it was good to get you on board. Steve Sullivan sent me a Facebook message saying, how come I'm not doing this with you guys, given the fact that I've done all the other ones?
Yeah.
about Harryhausen.
Yeah, I saw that, yeah.
Yeah, no, I had to be gracious. I had to graciously kind of say, no, we're not getting you on because you've done it with everybody else. Yeah, we done with people who are too promiscuous with the Harryhausen. With all due respect to Steve.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's about it. Thanks very much, Nick. I really appreciate you.
Well, thank you for having me on again.
Okay, anytime. We'll get back again soon. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not any specific feedback for the Martian Drive-In podcast this week. Elaine Walker did ask me whether there was an updated version of Martian Drive-In podcast 12 around. But no, I think it's just that the silly thing was glitching at the time. And the audio quality has suffered a little bit over the last couple of episodes. So I do apologise to everybody for that. And I am working on improving it with each episode. Got a brand new headset. And we're trying to get the Skype thing working into this podcast. There are some times when Nick's voice hasn't come through particularly well. And I do apologise for that. But apart from that, what I want to put to people is something, you let me know what you think. I was wondering whether I should re-merge Paleo Cinema with the Martian Drive-In podcast, whether I should put them all on the one RSS feed and then every 2 weeks you get one or the other. I can still keep them separate in other ways, but I was just wondering what people think about re-merging them or... are you happy to have them separate, or would you like them merged back together? I don't mind either way. I can afford to keep both Podbean accounts open, so there's really not an issue there. But let me know what you think. And also let me know anything you like about the Harryhausen, your favourite Harryhausens, some obscure stuff, any facts you've got about Ray Harryhausen. Very interesting, very influential character. And I think if you are above a certain age, his movies are definitely something that enriched your childhood and your upbringing. And there aren't enough people around that we can say that about. So that's about it for this time around. Thanks for listening. I'll be back in 2 weeks' time with another Paleo Cinema podcast. And I should have, as my guest, Vince Rotolo from the B-Movie Cast. We're going to be talking about Taxi Driver and another movie as yet to be announced. We don't quite know what it is yet. We're still in discussions about that. But Vince wanted to do Taxi Driver and it doesn't really fit into the B-Movie Cast. So he and I are going to explore us a little Travis Bickle. So that's about it this time around. Look after yourselves. If you live in a country with a female head of state, tell her to watch your back, because we've just lost ours and it's only in retrospect. And with a whole bunch of very interesting media comments, particularly from women, that we appreciate, that we're appreciating what we had. So look after yourselves, and I'll be back in 4 weeks with another Martian Drive-In, and in 2 weeks with another Paleo Cinema podcast.
It is such a good night to kiss. It is such a good night to dance. It is such a good night to Scooby-Dee-Dooby-Doo, Scooby-Dee-Dooby-Doo, Scooby-Dee-Dooby-Doo love. Thank you.
It is such a good night to dance. It is such a good night to Scooby-Dooby-Doo, Scooby-Dooby-Doo, Scooby-Dooby-Doo love. It is such a good night to kiss. It is such a good night to dance. It is such a good night to Scooby-Dooby-Doo, Scooby-Dooby-Doo, Scooby-Dooby-Doo love. It is such a good night to kiss. It is such a good night to kiss.